You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
Well, I've been staying with you this summer, listening to the sermons and reading along in the book of Psalms as we're spending the summer looking at a handful of Psalms. And Psalms are this unique part of the Bible. It's classified as wisdom literature. There's a few books like that. And it's different than lots of the rest of the Bible because in it you'll find things like poetry and song. And it's rich. It covers this vast expression of worship and of lament and everything in between to God. Christians throughout history have drawn upon the Psalms to find words appropriate to their situation. Even the New Testament writers draw upon the Psalms to find words to express themselves to God. And that's why we're looking at the Psalms, because we want to learn how to talk to God in all kinds of situations and all kinds of emotions. And that's the great thing about the Psalms, as you've been reading. You find real people going through real stuff, difficult things, great things, and you learn from them how to talk to God in those things. It's very real and authentic. It's what we would all want in our own relationship with God. Talking to God for most of us can be a real challenge. Like if you, after church, ask the people that are sitting around you this question, if you say, hey, how do you feel about God? And how does God feel about you? Most of the people you ask that would find it really hard to grab words to answer that question. One of the challenges for us is that we live in an information age, and so we know so much stuff about God. Yet we really struggle to talk to God, to relate to him personally. And so today we're going to look at Psalm 32. It is written by King David, and it's a psalm about confession and forgiveness. It's a psalm that teaches us how to talk to God when we've sinned. Now, my children, I have two boys, generally they have no problems talking to me. They know how to tell me all the things that they want. They know how to ask me to play over and over and over again. When we lay in bed at night, they love to just recount all the things that happened. And they can remember obscure stuff that I said, that was done. And some people would say this is a delay tactic. I prefer to think that they just really like hanging out with me. I'm going to stick with that preference. Even when they're angry at me, they can find words to express that. Not always the best words, but they can find them. So there is one situation, though, in which my kids really struggle, in which they seem paralyzed, like they don't have a tongue anymore. And that is the situation when I want them to talk about something they've done wrong. Like I'll say, hey, come here, let's talk about what you did. You know what you did. And they'll say, I don't remember. And I'll be like, man, you remember things I said in 4 years ago, and you're 7. So you definitely remember what you did 10 minutes ago. I know you do. And we'll go through this whole exhausting exercise of helping them remember what they did. And finally, once they remember, I say, okay, now, what would you like to say about that? And they'll say, I don't know what to say. I was like, yeah, no, you do. And I assure them, there's no right set of words. We're not looking for a formula here. I'm just saying, just talk about it. Just how do you feel about it? How do you think you would get right with the people that it affected in our house? Just talk about it. And then they'll say something like this. I don't remember. I don't know what to say. And they just kind of go through that cycle. And that can go on and on longer than you would think humanly possible. A long time. Sometimes Holden, in the middle of the conversation, will hide his face or pull a blanket up over his head, because he just doesn't want to be seen in it. Sometimes they'll act out, like they'll actually start doing worse things in hopes that I'll send them to their room, because they would rather be isolated than to talk about what they've done. It's hard to talk about what you've done wrong, particularly when there's shame attached to it. Shame will cause you to act in ways that are really nonsensical and unhealthy for you. And that's what my kids are feeling. They're feeling shame. They're feeling like they don't want to be seen for what they've done. And we all feel it as well. It's hard to talk about things that are connected to shame. And we don't pull a blanket over our head. I don't think you do that. You might. But we are relentlessly looking for ways to cover our shame and to hide. We don't want to talk about it. And our inability to talk with God about our sin, our tendency to cover and to hide, keeps us from a vital authenticity with God. It keeps us in the information age, and it hinders us from experiencing what we read in the Psalms. I want you to notice what David says here at the beginning of Psalm 32. David is talking about the blessed life, the good life. This is the life of true joy. And notice who he says it's for. It's for those who have been forgiven. And so the people who are most fulfilled, most content, most full of joy, have most peace, are not people who have not done wrong. It's the people who have experienced deeply God's forgiveness. It's the people that have learned to talk about it. And so we ask this question today: how do we talk to God when we feel weighed down by guilt and shame? And Psalm 32 is going to show us how to do that. It shows us first why we need forgiveness, why we need to confess our sin, but it also shows us how to do that, how to confess. And more than anything, throughout, what I hope you'll see is that it declares the joy of God's forgiveness. All right, let's start with why we need to confess our sin. In our culture, when we talk about sin, we're typically talking about sin in terms of guilt and pardon. Guilt is technically a courtroom term. It means you've done something wrong, you've come before the jury or the judge, it has been proven, and you've been sentenced to punishment that you deserve. That's guilt, all right? When Adam and Eve ate of the apple, they disobeyed the command of God. It wasn't really an apple, I don't know what it was, but they are guilty, right? Now, I think that's a very biblical way of talking about sin, but I think it's also important for us to acknowledge that sin is more complex than not doing what we should do or doing what we shouldn't do. In fact, our behaviors, what we do and don't do, actually indicates something going on inside of us. It points to a deeper reality that we love and worship something other than God. When Adam and Eve ate from the tree that God commanded them not to, it wasn't just a no-no. It wasn't just like, oh, you shouldn't have done that. Let's talk about that. It points to what was going on inside of them. In their heart and in their mind, they didn't trust God. They were full of desire to be like God, to take control of their lives. It's not just a legal infraction. It is that, absolutely. But it's also a relational transgression. In that act, they despised their creator. They rebelled against their king. They turned away from their father. You see, so it's not just the guilt of wrongdoing, it's shame. When you read Genesis 2, the commentary is that before they did this thing, they were naked and unashamed, which is the ultimate picture of selflessness thought, of being completely at peace with yourself and your surroundings. After they ate, the commentary is that their eyes were opened and they knew that they were naked. You see, so it's not just that their innocence had given way to guilt, their honor had given way to shame. Shame has to do with when you feel exposed and therefore you feel like cast out, you feel like you don't belong. That's what they felt. That's why they ran and hid from God. Can you imagine just walking around the Domain shopping center on a Saturday afternoon and all of a sudden realizing you don't have any clothes on? Just all of a sudden. Everybody around you is looking at you or trying not to look at you, whatever the case may be. But immediately you would cover, you would look for a place to hide, wouldn't you? That just simply illustrates the shame that came upon Adam and Eve has come upon all of us. We can't escape it. All of us right now have clothes on because that's the way we want to do it. Shame. Shame's more than embarrassment. Embarrassment can pass with time. Shame becomes part of who you are. It colors everything you think and see the world around you. That's what happened to Adam and Eve. That's what we all carry around as well. There's a lot of talk these days about raising the self-esteem level of our kids especially. And I don't think that's altogether a bad goal, because I think what they're tapping into is a problem that has been deeply embedded in humanity since Genesis 3. In fact, Ed Welch, who is a well-known counselor, says that when our culture talks about self-esteem, they're really just trying to describe what the Bible would call shame, except that they're leaving out the very important quality that our shame is first and foremost before God. What's interesting about our efforts to raise self-esteem, as I look at it, it seems that they're focused on approval from others and personal achievement. You know, we try to help kids feel approved of and help them gather up achievements so that they have high self-esteem. And I think it's kind of ironic, as adults, those are the very things that we begin to use to cover up our shame. Like, why are we constantly spinning the truth and putting our best foot forward? Because we're hoping that we can cover our shame with the approval of others. Why don't we want people to know the real us? Why don't we want them to see us in what we consider to be private? Because we're afraid that what they would see, we would be ashamed of. This is why many of us have really difficult time developing meaningful relationships. What about achievement? Let me ask you this. Why can't we take criticism very well? Well, because it means that we haven't achieved enough to cover our shame. This is why some of you work so much, because you're trying to cover your shame with success. This is why some of you are way overcommitted doing good things, because you hope that with your good deeds you can cover your shame. And of course, none of it ever works. It doesn't work. Let me ask you this. What are you trying to hide? Right? So guilt is, I'm in the courtroom and I've been sentenced to something that I know that I did. I'm guilty. Shame is that the trial was on TV. People know. I wanted to hide that from people. So you have to ask yourself, what am I trying to hide? Because that's a really good shortcut to identifying your shame. I think King David was trying to hide his adultery. I think this psalm, Psalm 32 and Psalm 51 and Psalm 38, perhaps all are related to this event. You know the story. David stays home when the army goes out to battle, and he has nothing to do. So he's up on the rooftop, and he takes note of a very beautiful woman named Bathsheba, and he decides that he wants to make her his own. And so he does. He's the king. You know, he can use his authority or abuse it, as it were, in that way. She conceives and is with child, and so David begins to cover. He calls her husband back from the battlefield, who, by the way, is Uriah, who was one of his most loyal friends. He calls Uriah back from battle and says, "Hey, Uriah, you've done a good job. Take a break. Go spend the night with your wife, and then we'll send you back out tomorrow." He's thinking they'll spend the night together, and then it will look all natural. Well, Uriah is an honorable man. So he says, I can't be with my wife while my buddies are out at battle. And so I won't do that. And so now David's got to go to plan B, right? So David sends orders to the commander to have Uriah move to the front lines so that he would be killed. I don't think when David started the cover-up that he thought that he would be willing to kill one of his most loyal friends. But that's what happens. When you start to cover, and then your mind is set on covering, it's like shopping for something that you want. Once you go down that road, you can't stop. And you just keep going, you keep looking, and you're going to buy that thing. Well, he is going to cover. That's the nature of cover-up. It snowballs deceit and lies and destruction. We end up doing things that we could have never imagined doing on the front end, because shame makes you act in ways that are nonsensical and unhealthy. So David has committed adultery. He wants to hide it, wants to cover it. I suspect that what David's trying to protect is his office and his reputation as king. I mean, there's a lot at stake. And I could see how David could think through it and perhaps believe that maybe even God's reputation was at stake here. It's amazing how we're able to convince ourselves that it really is better if no one knows about this. And so, just like David, we cover. We cover the shame we carry with us. We're not always conscious of it. Most of us probably can't even name our shame, but it's there. And we've devised all kinds of ways of interacting with one another that are really designed to protect ourselves from being exposed. And so if you're the kind of person that blames others or is constantly justifying yourself, well, that's just a way of protecting yourself from exposure. If you're the kind of person who's hypercritical about everything, well, that's just a way of diverting attention away from you. If you're given excessively to pleasure, to fantasy, well, those are just ways of deadening yourself to the shame that you sort of ambiguously know is there. None of it works, though. The more we try to hide, this is my own experience, it's the testimony of David, which we'll see in a second, the more we try to hide and push down and cover, the greater our shame becomes in us. Listen to what David says, verse 3. When I kept silent, when I covered and hid, my bones wasted away. Day and night, your hand was heavy upon me. My strength was dried up as by the heat of summer. When you don't deal with shame, it deals with you. Like physically, David is sick. It is possible to be so weighed down with guilt and shame that you get physically sick. Emotionally, David has lost joy. He is sapped. I think he's probably going through the duties of being king, of being God's representative on earth, but there's no joy in it. Psychologically, he's lost peace. You know, if you try to ignore guilt and shame, try to push it down and move on, your conscience has a way of like pushing it to the front. It doesn't matter how much time has passed. It doesn't matter how much you've changed. It doesn't matter if you get a change of scenery. It'll come back. It'll come back. Spiritually, David has lost intimacy. You know, when you don't deal with stuff, it's amazing how you don't feel like praying. You don't want to look at God in the eye. You don't want to talk to him. In fact, you even distance yourself from community. You don't fully commit because you just don't feel the drive to. If you don't deal with guilt and shame, it deals with you. And so how do we deal? How do we talk to God about this? Well, this is what the Bible calls confession. After David says that he kept silent, his bones wasted away, God's hand was heavy upon him, his strength was dried up. Verse 5, he says, I acknowledged my sin to you. I didn't cover my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin. This is confession. One night at our dinner table, Holden had done something, and I wanted him to talk about it and wanted him to apologize to whoever it was affected by it. Holden said, Dad, can I ask you a question? I was like, yes, please do. He said, why do I have to talk about it? Why do I have to say it when you already know what it is? And I said, that's a really good question. I said, you know, in Genesis, what happened, right? He says, yes. I said, well, why did God come to Adam and say, where are you? What have you done? And he looked at me like I was cornering him on something. And we talked about it for a while, and he finally came to realize God did that because he wanted the relationship with Adam. He knew that for Adam to be healed and restored, he would have to come out and look God in the eye and talk about it. Confession is not a formula. It's about restoring a relationship. It's really the only way you can deal with your shame. You know, you don't confess your way out of shame. Shame is overcome when, in the context of a relationship, someone knows everything about you and still accepts and loves you. Confession is a means of entering, then, into the vulnerability and the glory of that kind of relationship. God comes to us and says, where are you? What have you done? Not to condemn, but to invite us into relationship. And so how do we respond? What do we say when we come out and there's God? Well, David gives us some helpful instruction here. verse 5, he says, I acknowledge my sin to you. You. The first thing you have to do to deal with sin and guilt and shame is to turn to God. When the prophet Nathan confronts David, David, I think, thought he was in the clear. It had been a little while. Nobody said anything. But then Nathan comes, the spokesperson of God, because God always sees. And Nathan confronts David, and the first thing David says is, I've sinned against the Lord. In Psalm 51, when he writes out his confession, he says, against you, Lord, you only have I sinned. Well, certainly he sinned against lots of other people. And there will be a time and a place for confession and repentance in those relationships. But what David's acknowledging is the thing that the self-esteem movement leaves out, which is, above all else, my sin is against God, my shame is before God. Against you and you only have I sinned. This is how you distinguish between worldly and godly sorrow. Worldly sorrow turns to people and to self because it's trying to manage the damage. It's looking for cover. Godly sorrow just turns to God because it's looking for forgiveness. So first, turn to God. Second, be honest. David says, I acknowledge my sin to you, and I did not cover my iniquity. Be honest about your guilt, what you've done, and your shame, how you feel about it. David says, blessed is the one whose sin is covered and in whose spirit there is no deceit, in verse 2, meaning he's all out there. He's not hiding anything. When David came clean, he came really clean. I mean, he let it all out. He writes about it in several places. He's not shying away from his story. And for that matter, God doesn't shy away from David's story. I mean, it's crazy. God had, before all of this, said, David, now that is a man after my own heart. He's going to obey me. He makes him king, and then David does this. Yet, God is not ashamed for us to be well acquainted with the failure of his king, of his saints. If it weren't for our knowledge of the depth of David's sin and failure, we wouldn't know the depth of God's mercy and grace. God's glorified not only in our strength, but maybe even more so in our weakness. So we've got to be honest. I heard this great phrase about a couple months ago from a pastor here in town. He said, in their communities, they're really trying to work hard to help each other share the last 10%. I was like, well, what is that? He said, well, you know, when people are talking about their life or confessing their sin, they don't give you the whole story. You know, they'll begin by talking about things that like are common to everybody because everybody will agree and there won't be any judgment. It's like, yep, been there, got it. And they'll share that. And most people maybe will just stop at that. But if there's a sin that might threaten their belonging in the community, that might threaten their standing at work or in church, they won't give you that. That's the last 10%. It's the part of the story, you know, whatever part of your story you think would shock people, that they would be like, whoa, you feel like they would reject you, that's the 10% in your life. The 10% is also the things beneath the sin, right? Whatever it is I love and worship other than God, that's underneath the behavior, that's the last 10%. The 10%, getting that out there, putting words to that, is really hard work. But that's where the shame lives. Some of you are really frustrated in your walk with God because you feel like, I'm being honest, I'm in community, I'm reading the Bible, I'm praying, and I cannot shake this sense of like, God doesn't accept me, people don't accept me. More often than not, it's because you're still pushing down the 10%. It's not always there, but it comes up. Ed Welch says this, the first steps out of shame will be the hardest. These are the anti-denial steps in which we will put shame into words. He says, you can't do battle with something that's nameless, and too often, shame eludes accurate description. We must find words that bring shame out into the open where it can be seen and fought against. It's hard, but that's where the joy is. Third thing, hide in God. Everyone needs to be covered. And what David discovered is this, is when I try to cover my sin, God seems distant. But when I stop covering my sin, God covers it. Look what he says, verse 5, I did not cover my iniquity. Verse 2, which is his proclamation of the aftermath, he says, blessed is the one whose sin the Lord covers. He learned to hide in God. In verse 6, he calls upon everyone to confess. And then he says, surely in the rush of great waters, they will not reach him. And so in the rush of trouble, in the rush of attack, in the rush of accusation, which are the waters that are coming around the person who's confessed, they will not touch him. They won't reach him. Why? Because verse 7, you, Lord, are a hiding place for me. You preserve me from trouble. You surround me with shouts of deliverance. What David discovered is that when I stopped covering my sin, when I stopped hiding, God became my hiding place. And all that I was afraid of that would knock me down can't touch me because God surrounds me. One of the Apostle Paul's favorite phrases for talking about salvation is the phrase, in Christ. And what he's saying is when we are in Christ, united with him, we are protected. He is our shelter, our hiding place from the wrath that we deserve because of our sin. You know what crucifixion is? Crucifixion is death by exposure and humiliation. They strip you naked. They put you up on a cross. Your hands and feet are bound. There is nothing you can do. You are laid bare publicly. People walk by, they jeer, and they mock. Jesus went through the ultimate exposure, was stripped, so that we could be clothed in his righteousness, so that we could be in him, and he be our hiding place. Turn to God, be honest about all of it. Hide in God. Fourth, ground yourself in his steadfast love. Verse 10, many are the sorrows of the wicked, but steadfast love surrounds the one who trusts in the Lord. Steadfast love is covenant language. It speaks to God's character, his unchanging, unrelenting commitment to his people in every possible way. I think it's why Paul can say to Timothy, God is faithful even when we're faithless because he can't deny himself. In other words, God has bound himself up with his people, and even when they are faithless, which they are, over and over, God remains faithful to them. One of the real problems with shame is it turns us in upon ourselves, and so we have a hard time getting over it. The secret is to think more about God than you do your own shame. To think more about his glory and his character and his love. To rehearse the truths of the gospel that God's approval of you is about his faithful, steadfast love, not about your worthiness. Ground yourself in the love of God. I acknowledge my sin to you. I did not cover. I said, I will confess. And you forgave the iniquity of my sin. That's David's story. I've seen this story play out a number of times in my own life and other people's lives. A friend I had a number of years ago had come to faith in Christ and was experiencing a lot of growth, was really feeling like he was being transformed. But then things took a turn. His world got really dark. He couldn't sleep at night. He was seeing things that he felt like were demonic in his room, in the street. I mean, he felt like he was feeling claustrophobic about even going out. God felt distant. He felt alone. He felt whatever he tried to describe to people, they couldn't understand. And so, man, we prayed with this guy. We counseled him. He confessed sin. I mean, we did everything we could, but nothing changed. Finally, after a fair amount of suffering and pain, the last 10% came out. It came out that he, in his childhood, had done some really grievous things. I mean, things that would shock you. Things that would probably make you really angry at him. And so there was a lot of risk. I mean, it was tremendous courage for him to bring out the last 10%, because it was risk relationally that this new community that he had loved might reject him. It was legal risk, consequences, going to jail. It's a lot on the line. But he just couldn't handle it anymore. He just broke. He said, "I will confess. I won't cover." And he did, and he began even to confess to the people that were affected by that. And as he did, even in the midst of not knowing what would happen to him, the fog began to lift. He was free. I mean, he was guilty, but he was forgiven. He was exposed. I mean, he was out there, but God covered him. "I will not hide. I will not cover. I'll come clean." Confession's risky because you think that God's going to reject you, but he accepts you. You think that he's going to punish you, but he blesses you. You think that he's going to move away from you, but he actually runs toward you. It just blows all your categories. That's the love of God. Our challenge is not that we don't know what that is, God's love and sin and confession. Our challenge, I really believe, is that we don't know how to appropriate those things firsthand. We don't know what it means for that to touch the deep, dark parts of our soul. And so whenever I come across someone who seems to be tapping into that, experiencing it firsthand, regardless of what they know, it's very refreshing to me. And that happened a few weeks ago. We baptized a couple guys, and afterward I was talking to one of their friends, Will, and he just began to tell me a little bit of his story. And so I want to bring Will up and have him share a little bit of his story with you. And he can't share everything. Yeah, come on up. And to Will's defense, I just told him this today and just said, don't think about it until then. And there's a lot to share, but I would love for you to share a little bit what we talked about earlier. Again.
Will called me about 2 hours ago and asked if I would share some of my experience. And I was a little hesitant at first, and But the truth is that, you know, the freedom in Jesus has completely transformed my life. And, before that, Christianity is relatively new to me. And for several months, people would ask me questions, or I would think about it. Do I feel like I'm forgiven? I would tell them yes. You know, I was reading the Gospels. You know, I was coming to church. I was doing all these things, and I thought I was forgiven, and I felt a little freedom. But you know, there were still times where I was replaying certain sins or replaying certain scenarios and situations that I just couldn't seem to let go of. You know, and I was just like, why can I not let go of these things? And I realized that I was missing a big part of this whole deal. And you know, it wasn't that I felt like God was going to punish me or whatever the case may be, but I wasn't really experiencing the true freedom that Jesus had offered or does offer. And I remember just getting to a place where, you know, I was desperate, you know, and I was sick of continuing to play the sins over and over again, and just being ashamed and feeling just so unworthy. You know, I would come in here on Sundays and I would sing, but I didn't feel a part of. And so I got to a point of desperation and just pleading to God, you know, help me to feel forgiven. You know, help me to truly feel the freedom that Jesus has to offer. And shortly after that, I mean, there wasn't like a burning bush moment or anything like that, but this idea of finally being accepted, you know, was so apparent in my life. And you know, to feel accepted despite my failures is like truly, like to feel that in your heart is like the most amazing thing I'd ever come across. To be finally deemed worthy and to feel accepted was truly, you know, a miracle in my eyes. And, you know, over the past several weeks, I just find myself, you know, constantly thanking Christ for accepting me and forgiving me, and then also just thanking God for thanking God to for me to finally be able to feel that freedom, to express that freedom, because that's something I was incapable of feeling before. So thanks for letting me share.
Yeah, thanks, Will. I mean, that's it, right? That's what you want. Wouldn't you trade like a whole bunch of stuff you know to feel it in your heart, to be transformed by it? That's the mark of someone who has really understood the forgiveness of God, is they're rejoicing. They're thankful. Like, a heavy sermon is one in which things are exposed in your life that you weren't aware of, and there's conviction. This isn't a heavy text. This is a text of thanksgiving. It's not exposing things. It's talking about what to do with the things that are exposed. If you feel heavy, it's probably because you're struggling with the idea of bringing that out before God. The mark of someone who's brought it out is thanksgiving and joy. That's why David says, "Blessed is the one whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man in whom the Lord counts no iniquity." That's firsthand rejoicing. David's not just teaching about forgiveness, he's exulting in it. Will isn't just learning about forgiveness, he's living it. And may we be the kind of church who won't settle for anything less, who would throw ourselves upon the grace and the mercy of God and say, "I won't cover anymore." Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.